Yeah, so go ahead and let's make it as informal as possible.
Right. Okay, well, I'd like to continue the discussion about planet formation and maybe mention an alternative viewpoint about how planets could be formed, which is, I think, radically different from the standard one. And I should just mention this was work that was done largely in collaboration with Bernhard Mehlig, who was here in the preceding month. So the standard picture for planet formation, which Hubert told us about, or started to tell us about a couple of days ago, is one that's based upon the idea that planets form by aggregation of dust particles in a circumstellar disk around a newly forming star. I should explain a little bit maybe about how I came to be interested in this topic. I'm not an astrophysicist, but I have had an interest in particles suspended in turbulent media for a while. So it was natural to take a look at this mechanism. And I found myself a little bit doubtful about whether it was entirely convincing. There are a few theoretical problems with it, I think. And there's also some observational issues. And in particular, as we find out more about extrasolar planets, I think some of these problems are becoming more significant. So what I'd like to tell you about is a possible alternative approach, which we termed concurrent collapse. And this, I think, certainly does give a more plausible explanation for the origin of a certain subset of planetary systems. Those are the large gas giant planets in eccentric orbits. And I think that this alternative approach looks promising as a potential mechanism for the formation of all planetary systems. And it also provides potentially some insights into some long-standing puzzles. One is the origin of FU Orionis outbursts. These are outbursts of very much increased intensity in young stars. And another one is the origin of chondrules, little glassy bead-like particles that are found in meteorite samples on Earth. So we heard, as I said, about the standard model. This model seems very well adapted to what we knew about planetary systems until about 15 years ago, when the only real example we had was our own solar system. In the solar system, the planets are all in the same plane, which is more or less the equatorial plane of the Sun. And they all move in, to a pretty good approximation, circular orbits, with the exception of Mercury, which is the smallest object and has a somewhat eccentric orbit. So having seen the solar system as an example, it's very natural to think that planets do form in disk-like structures, such as the circumstellar disk around a young star shown in this artist's impression, and this is a real one seen edge on. In the past 15 years or so, there's been a lot of discoveries of extrasolar planets, and I think the big lesson from these discoveries is that very, very little has been found that might have been expected. So a lot of these objects turned out to be in very, very different types of orbit from the ones in our own solar system. This is data from 2006. It illustrates, for example, that there are very, very large numbers of planets in highly eccentric orbits compared to the ones in our own solar system. And for a mechanism that forms planets in apparently of necessity in circular orbits. If you start off with material orbiting in a circumstellar disk, it seems hard to avoid the first stages of planet formation having bodies of material moving in circular orbits around the star. It's a bit of a challenge to explain how you get extrasolar planets forming with these very large eccentricities. And as time's going on, I don't think this problem is diminishing. There are now observations from transiting exoplanets where the inclination of the planet relative orbit relative to the equatorial plane of the star can be deduced, and some of the planets are found to be orbiting in extremely inclined orbits. And there are also, I think, by now examples of retrograde orbits where the planet orbits in the opposite sense to the rotation of the star. So these observations, I think, are a challenge to the conventional theory. Now there is an answer that,
There's been this claim that our own solar system is unstable on timescales of several billion years, right?
Yeah.
So and that we just got lucky. So we live in a system that did not go chaotic.
Now I think the claims of instability, the ones I'm aware of, are largely confined to the future fate of Mercury, which is the lightest body. I'm not aware, I'm not a specialist in this area, but I'm not aware of any claims that the whole solar system is likely to go unstable. It would seem
it's the other way around, so stability can never be proven for a system.
Yeah.
It's just that one can say we stay at least for this and that much time stable in the current configuration.
Yeah.
And it's for us it cannot be shown for too long in the future. So
that's
dynamical things have happened in the past of our solar systems, like the outer planets have been reversed and crazy resonances.
Yes, indeed. Yep.
So more eccentric days than today.
Yep.
And
yep.
We had this thing called the large heavy bombardment.
Fairly early in the history.
Yes.
Wow. Bombardment by
3.8 billion years ago. Which
Sorry?
Was 3.8 billion years ago, which was way after the formation started.
Meteorites bombardment by what?
No, it's basically minor bodies from the solar system, like planetesimals, asteroids, comets, all crashing in the larger planets, like also into the Earth.
And so that was enhanced, a serious enhancement. So at that point, people do believe that there was an instability taking place. Yeah. And of course, now we are living in the aftermath.
And I think there is indeed evidence that there was a period of instability when Jupiter and Saturn reversed. But the expectation is that if something's been orbiting nicely for billions of years, it's going to stay that way. I think that a very telling aspect of this, however, comes from an observation about basically from this scatter plot. This is a scatter plot of eccentricity versus the planetary mass. And you'll see that eccentric orbits seem to be correlated with masses, planets of a very high mass. The most eccentric ones are bodies that are much heavier than, for the most part.
The mass of the star here does not count. Try also to account for the different star masses in different systems. So I would guess that it's not a matter of a planet mass, but of ratio of planets to the star.
I don't see. I think that what is important here is the ratio of the bodies that are interfering with each other. Now, the proposals that enable planets to be put into eccentric orbits are concerned with interactions between the planets in orbit about a star.
But they compete this interaction with the interaction with the star, which want to make, yes, to keep it circular.
That's right, but observation-wise, so most stars are plus minus or a factor of two.
Ah, so they are practically the same.
Just by observation reasons.
Yeah. Okay, so the people have, of course, tried to correlate with every conceivable variable, including the mass of the star. Most of these things don't produce any striking correlations. This is one of the things that does produce a striking correlation. And the message is that the heavier a planet is, the more likely you are to find it in an eccentric orbit. Now, if the standard model is appealing to instabilities, well, this is not good news, because it's easier to perturb a light body into an eccentric orbit than a heavy body. In order to push a heavy body into an eccentric orbit, you have to have something even heavier to push it. And in these cases, there's one planet has been detected that's very massive. No other massive object capable of perturbing it away. Yep.
So, but this is exactly the correlation with the standard picture shows in planet-disk interaction, that starting from a certain mass around Jupiter, the interaction between the massive disk, which is more massive than the planet, is pumping eccentricity in the system. And then you are generating from this tidal interaction between disk and planet very eccentric massive planets. So this correlation is completely perfect with the standard disk gap opening
might be. I would like to see a theoretical argument that makes it that increases the eccentricity as you increase the mass of the body being perturbed.
So the instability is only triggered starting from certain masses of the planet.
Yeah.
So, but I can show you the references. So.
Yeah. Okay, so I could. I've been invited to study that, and if shown the references, I will. Yeah. Okay, so this, I think, is a reason to be worried about the standard model.
Also, because the large planet may mean more unstable system.
It may
mean more unstable system.
You mean in relation
because
to...
Because all planets are very small, then it's a stable system.
Yeah.
So you make some planet larger, you make your system more. You make the instability basin of whatever strange...
Yes, but the likely outcome is that... the heavier body is going to just cause the lighter bodies to go into eccentric orbits or to be ejected. I think it's physically obvious that as you increase the mass of the planet, it becomes harder to perturb its orbit.
And are you saying that is not true?
Sorry?
Are you saying that the wisdom is that that's indeed not true?
He says
it's physically plausible that a heavier body cannot be put in.
No, I don't think it's that trivial, because as long as you have an instability, you actually don't know where it ends up, because it's a dynamical system with a pretty complicated phase space, and that in which attractor you end up does not necessarily mean.
So one thing in our own solar system, for instance, Jupiter is a dominant dynamical partner, and this planet is stabilizing the inner solar system. So it's also protecting us.
Well, you would be talking about Jupiter itself, right? Would you not? Did I understand you correctly that you would
be talking about general, so an even more massive planet?
Yes. Right. I mean, you're about the most massive planet. You're talking about the most massive planet, right?
Well, in these cases, the planet that has been detected is presumably the most massive
one.
A possibility is that. If you have another planet at a very large orbital distance, such things are much harder to detect. But we simply don't know.
So then the argument that you brought up doesn't apply, right? Because your argument wouldn't apply to that particular case.
Why?
Because he's talking about the most massive body of the system. You're talking about Jupiter disturbing other bodies.
Which is our most massive planet?
Yeah, but we are interested in who disturbs Jupiter.
If you gave an argument that Jupiter was going to go off into an eccentric orbit, then we'd have something to discuss. But
right, yeah, so
what you're saying, I think, looks like a dead end.
Would have gone into a very eccentric orbit.
I mean, what he's saying is that the really massive object is actually not massive, because the disk is massive.
Yes.
And the disk is the big mass that drives everything.
Right.
Right? That's what you're saying. And what you're saying is that above a certain mass of the object that's interacting with the disk, you get eccentricity. That's what I understood what you're saying. I don't know. I don't say whether I understand it, but that's what I understood.
Okay. That is a possible get out. However, another point I would make about these data is that compared to the existing theories which are propounded, it turns out that there are a lot of very, very heavy planets around, which seems to indicate a much higher efficiency of conversion of material in the circumstellar disk into planets. And that, I think, is another worrying aspect. And you could start to debate whether these bodies really are small compared to the total mass of material which would have been in the accretion disk at the time when they formed. Never mind the question of whether that material was able to organize itself in such a way as to project the planet into an unstable orbit. Mm-hmm. Some other points. The standard model does depend on some rather complicated kinetic issues. You have to consider whether the dust grains collide sufficiently rapidly to be able to form planets in the lifetime of the accretion disk, which, as we heard the other day, is a few million years. And then there's another issue, which is that the material in the accretion disk, which is supposed to form the planets, initially consists of very tiny grains. They're just grains of material about, perhaps a tenth of a micron across, coming from the interstellar medium. And the standard model envisages these things sticking together by collision. They make larger and larger clusters. But a problem is that you have to ask what happens about when two clumps of material collide. Now remember that these clumps are really grains that are just stuck together by van der Waals forces. You can hardly imagine a more fragile system. When you make quantitative estimates of the relative collisions speeds, you find that these clumps of material are going to have larger relative collision speeds as they grow, and that you very rapidly get to estimates where perhaps a 10 centimeter size ball would collide with another 10 centimeter size ball at speeds of about 10 meter per second. That's the speed of a not terribly serious car crash. It would do damage to a car. I have a lot of difficulty really believing that a ball of fluff is going to survive such a collision without being disrupted. As well as the observational issues, there are certain kinetic ones. I'll skip over some of the quantitative aspects. And then there are some issues that it would be good to understand something about if they did turn out to have something to do with planet formation. And one I'd like to mention is FU Orionis outbursts. Now these are outbursts of very sharply increased luminosity that are observed in young stars. And they're just named after the first example, which was seen in 1937. And it's very hard to categorize the common features of these because they are in fact extremely variable. So they have a very quick rise time, 1 to 10 years is typical, a rather slower decay. And the increase in the magnitude of the star could be, in the most extreme cases, 6 astronomical orders, roughly a factor of 1,000. But in many cases, the increase of luminosity is observable, but much smaller. And there are published explanations for these outbursts based on instabilities of circumstellar accretion disks. But I think that people that know the field admit that the calculations are somewhat forced. You have to take rather extreme choices of parameters to get instabilities that have a fast rise time and a slower decay. So that's one thing one would like to understand. Another thing is that meteorite samples on Earth often are found to have glassy, rocky beads inside, called chondrules. They're about a millimeter in diameter, typically. And these seem to be very old. They seem to date, as far as anybody can tell, from the formation of the solar system, or from the early stages. And the problem here is, where does the heating that creates them come from? The standard mechanism for planet formation keeps material pretty cold until it forms kilometer-sized planetesimals. And once you've formed planetesimals, it's very hard to get small pieces of material away from them and into the general surrounding medium. That, in fact, was the definition of a planetesimal that you gave.
But this is concurrent. So chondrule formation is not at early stages, but it's during the entire formation time of planet formation. So even after planetesimals are already existing,
yep,
and maybe even planets, there are still chondrules to be formed.
That may
must be some unidentified effect which is operating in the disk for a very long time. So.
Yep. Well, okay, but you concede that it's an unidentified effect.
Yes, sure.
I think I can give a possible explanation. Okay. So I said that I'd like to explore a possible alternative explanation, concurrent collapse. And the idea is that, well, it's just a variant on the model for star formation. Stars form when a cloud of gas in the interstellar medium collapses by gravitational self-attraction. The cloud is originally very, very large, much larger than a single stellar mass. But as a mass of material collapses under the force of gravity, its density increases. And as the density increases, you expect that the gene's mass will decrease. And that's consistent with a cloud of gas fragmenting into smaller and smaller pieces as the collapse proceeds. I think I have an illustration of that. So this is a simulation done by Bates and co-workers. An initially pretty homogeneous ball of gas collapsing under gravity fragments into smaller and smaller pieces as the process proceeds. Now, the presumption has always been that the smallest pieces you end up with are going to be the stars. But here there's always been, or at least since the mid-1970s, there's been a theoretical problem. If you ask what terminates the fragmentation of a body as it collapses, the answer seems to be that fragmentation ceases when the body is not losing energy efficiently by radiation. When the collapse starts to become adiabatic, the gene's mass no longer decreases as the density increases. So when you switch from isothermal to adiabatic conditions in the collapse, that's when fragmentation ceases. That crossover is associated with the material starting to become opaque to radiation. And if you make an estimate of the size of the body where this opacity starts to become important, you don't end up with something that's the mass of a typical star. You end up with something that is about 5 or 10 times the mass of Jupiter. So I'm going to argue that gravitational collapse produces bodies that tend to be clustered together. They tend to be orbiting around each other in the initial stages, and that the smallest bodies produced will not be of standard stellar size, but will be of the size of gas giant planets.
Do you also mention what happens to the most of the small guys in Matthew's simulations?
They collide with each other and they form.
They get ejected from the system.
And some of them, yes. So in Bates simulations, what happens is that some of the small objects get ejected. A lot of the rest, because of tidal forces acting between them, spiral closer and closer to each other, making larger and larger bodies. And this is consistent with my hypothesis, which is that the a lot of the smaller bodies initially produced will end up sticking together. Those will become the protostars. Some of them will be ejected. But some of them will remain in orbit around the protostar, and those are objects that I'm going to call juvenile planets.
The simulations, are they MHD or two fluid?
They are actually not MHDs.
This was single fluid?
They're not MHD, and I know they were done by an SPH method. I know that it was a fairly complicated algorithm that was supposed to put in details about material opacities, etc. But I'm not a specialist in that field, so I can't tell you everything about the simulation.
In this case, I have a problem. How can they have this collapse? How they can solve the angular momentum problem of the collapsing cores? Even if you start with a turbulent configuration, every bit has some angular momentum, and if it's there is no interaction through magnetic tension with the rest of the material, you know that you cannot really get a collapse. You are getting a huge pancake comparable with the initial cloud.
As well as objects collapsing under gravitational force, there is also a fragmentation. And it's the fragmentation aspect that solves the angular momentum issue. So the individual objects separate from each other in such a way that they're there is still the overall.
I understand this, but usually it's happening that magnetic braking is faster than the other process. So it's an interesting possibility that you're considering, but may not be the actual what's happening.
You are right to raise that point. This argument, these simulations were not magnetohydrodynamic. And one could argue that perhaps magnetohydrodynamics saves the day for the standard picture. However, I don't know of any. While I know of a first principles estimate for the smallest mass of a body that can be produced by gravitational collapse, giving 5 or 10 Jupiter masses, I don't know of any first principles estimate for working out the effect of magnetohydrodynamics to modify that figure. I see this as a possibility, a possible criticism, as I'm saying, but there isn't a quantitative result to back it up.
Just a quick comment. So up to this stage, you are still in the standard picture of star and planet formation. That you have these many things and you see the pieces around it.
In
MHD simulations, the first things which have been done there was ideal MHD, and or only some few non-ideal effects, and then the angular momentum transport in some cases was too efficient that stars formed but no disks anymore, so which is a clear contradiction to observation. So
yeah, but then there are these issues of resolution.
Exactly. They are working on this. So, and now they have simulations on where you see it's a question on what's the alignment between magnetic fields and rotation axis of your cloud is, and so on. So, but this is really research in progress. So.
Yeah. Right. Okay. But my hypothesis is that gravitational collapse produces both protostars and smaller bodies of the size of large gas giant planets bound in the gravitational vicinity. And inevitably, these smaller bodies will be formed with eccentric orbits. So if the problem is, can you explain the large population of planets which are found to be of several Jupiter masses and in eccentric orbits, well, by this approach, you're already there, you've done it. Next question, though, would be, can you explain anything else beyond that? Well, I want to argue that the smaller substellar objects that are produced, so I'll call them juvenile planets, well, obviously, initially, they're just going to be gas giants. Their composition would be similar to that of the interstellar medium. But can they produce something like the other types of planets which are seen, ones with a different composition, richer in metals, smaller objects, and maybe rocky planets? And here it's possible to make an argument that the interaction of the juvenile planets with the circumstellar disk around the protostar can cause a radical transformation in the structure of these juvenile planets.
And they're made of the same material, what kind of radical interaction could be?
I'll get on to that. So there are various types of things that could happen. The juvenile planet will be moving in orbit in such a way that it must intersect the circumstellar disk. So that introduces the possibility that, well, not the possibility, the inevitability that it will be flying through a cloud of gas with typically a very high relative velocity. The Keplerian velocity of the Earth is 3 times 10 to the 4 meters per second, I think. So relative speeds of 1,000 or 10,000 meters per second would be very possible. And because the juvenile planets would be created in elliptical orbits, well, bodies with elliptical orbits, if you have more than one of them, there's going to be a possibility of a collision, or if not a direct collision, a very close approach which could cause a tidal disruption of each body. So the two types of effects would be associated with interaction with the circumstellar disk and the possibility of a collision. And let's just see what type of possibilities arise from this.
So the juvenile planets, they consist of hydrogen and helium and so on?
And 1 or 2% of metals, yes. Yeah. One possibility, there are two things that could happen as the juvenile planet interacts with the accretion disk. One is that there can be a transfer of momentum in such a way as to circularize the orbit of the juvenile planet. And the other is that there can be a transfer of material. Because of the very high relative velocity, material could be ablated away from the outer layers of the juvenile planet and into the accretion disk. So I'll just illustrate what sort of estimates could be made. Let's think about the transfer of momentum. I'm going to consider a juvenile planet that's, well, Jupiter mass, Jupiter density, Jupiter radius. I'm going to put it in roughly Jupiter's sustained orbit. And it's going to be moving through a gas disk which has a typical density of 1.6 times 10 to the minus 3 kilograms per cubic meter. So that's a reasonable model, a reasonable value from Sunyaev accretion disk models. And what you find from this is that, if you're punching out a hole in the accretion disk of radius, of area 10 to the 16 square meters, going through material of that density, in each orbit you're going to displace about 10 to the minus 4 of the fraction, a fraction of 10 to the minus 4 of the mass of the juvenile planet. So this estimate would indicate that you then train the juvenile planet to be in a circular orbit corresponding to that of the circumstellar disk in about 10 to the 4 orbits, which is much less than the lifetime of the accretion disk. Well, of course, you can even ridicule an estimate of this type. You could say, oh, this guy could have put any numbers in there and gotten a different answer. That's perfectly true. But it's not really a particularly relevant criticism, because the fact is that if you look at the population of extrasolar planets, you find that there are a lot of them in eccentric orbits. There are also a lot of them, in particular the hot Jupiter population, in very circular orbits. So my point would be that depending on the exact choice of numbers, the planet might have a circularized orbit, or it might remain in an elliptical orbit.
So starting from some 10 Jupiter masses, which is 3,000 Earth masses, so these contained initially like 30 Earth masses mm-hmm. of solids. Of course,
yep.
The inner planets are at most one Earth mass, and also the inner four planets we have in our solar system have different chemical compositions.
Yes, yep.
So this must be some additional effect then.
Yep.
What is changing this?
Yep. The other aspect is that there can be a transfer of material from the planet to the circumstellar disk.
Okay.
And way this might affect the composition, this transfer of material would do two things. It would reduce the mass of the juvenile planet, and it could also affect the composition. Because over time, the heavier material will sink to the interior of the planet and will be harder to remove by the ablation of material from the upper layers. So this mechanism can both explain the existence of smaller planets of whatever size you wish, and planets that are richer in metals than the interstellar medium.
Mm-hmm.
So it has the potential to explain the origin of other types of planets. This would depend on calculations being done. But at this stage, unlike the standard model, which seems to lead to difficulties, this is at least an unknown quantity, and I think there are no obvious difficulties with this alternative hypothesis.
Well, isn't the same mechanism would require it to be circular, as long as, you know, just going through the gas make it into the plane, that would also make it circular and not eccentric the orbit, no?
So the point is that interaction with the gas will tend to make it circular, and whether...
Then you better slow up.
No, because if I'd put the planet further out where the gas density is much smaller, instead of...
They first go into the plane and then there is not enough gas to make them circular, that's your...
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the circularization would depend on basically on the amount of mass that the planet has to displace over the lifetime of the accretion disk. Now, if the mass that it's displacing is small compared to its own mass, that's not going to circularize its orbit. It will remain in the elliptical orbit. If it would have to displace many multiples of its own mass, the orbit must circularize. And the point is that depending upon the initial orbital parameters of the system, you can end up with either result.
My guess would be that as you go like this through the disk, Mm-hmm. Then you just puncture it with the radius of a planet. Now, if you're already in the plane and you start and go in this eccentric orbit, you sweep a lot of material because you are all the time in the plane where there is a lot of material.
Yes, so exactly.
It's a much more effective mechanism than just going like this and getting into
the plane. But if both is on a Keplerian motion, if you're circular, then there is no relative velocity, so you have to be then in the opposite direction.
Yeah, but the whole idea is that I came out of somewhere and I am not in sync with this disk.
So they were all years put in the same rotation direction around our sun.
Entrainment with the circumstellar disk would tend to move planets towards being in the same rotation direction as the star. Depending on the orbital parameters that you choose, and as Grisha says, upon the inclination of the orbit relative to the circumstellar disk, going through obliquely is going to be very inefficient at circularization. Going through nearly in the same plane would be very efficient. Then you can either have circularization or not. And this is entirely consistent with what's seen in the current exoplanet data. Can one... time's moving on, but can one say anything else? Well, I said that there could be collisions between these juvenile planets, or at least events where they approach each other very closely. Now, again, this is uncertain, but it looks very intriguing. Depending on the type of orbital parameters you can choose, you can get guesses that collisions are almost going to be inevitable in some cases and extremely unlikely in others. But if a collision did happen, what might the effects of it be? Well, if two gas giant planets come close enough to each other to cause tidal disruption, that would presumably scatter material throughout the circumstellar disk. And some of this material would have to find its way into the star. And what would the consequences of that be? Well, if additional material falls into the star, there will be an increase of luminosity. And let's see how this increase of luminosity compares with what's known about FU Orionis outbursts. Well, an FU Orionis outburst increases the luminosity of a star by up to a factor of 1,000 for a period of perhaps 10 years. That's equivalent, you can estimate, to putting roughly a Jupiter mass of material into the star over a 10-year period. So the most violent FU Orionis outbursts are consistent with a Jupiter mass of material hitting the star. This would happen in an event with a rise time comparable to an orbital period, say 1 to 10 years, and there would presumably be a slower decay as material less and less material fell in with a smaller and smaller rate, perhaps a fall time of 10 to 100 years. So this type of event could be an explanation for FU Orionis outbursts. The numbers, as much as we know them, add up. And it's also consistent with the fact that these outburst events are extremely variable. The results of the collision would also be extremely variable. Some collisions would dump a lot of material into the star, others very little.
Have they observed repeated outbursts for the same star?
I'm not an expert on this, but as far as I'm aware, the time series are not long enough for it to be clear if it's a periodic phenomenon or a quasi-periodic phenomenon or not. Even in terms of the numbers of stars that have these outbursts, that's rather uncertain, but the review articles I read suggest that about between 10 and 50% of stars will have an outburst event over their lifetime. Collisions could produce increases of luminosity of the star. They could also provide another means of making rocky planets. If you scatter material over the accretion disk, the scattered material could, in effect, be like the planetesimals or the building blocks for planet formation in the standard scenario. But this would avoid all of the problems of explaining how small dust grains are stuck together. If you disrupt something that already consists of rocky material, the problems are greatly reduced. You can even, and this is a very crude estimate, you can even make a rough estimate for the expected size of chondrons. And this does give quite a reasonable value. So this is based upon the idea that when a collision occurs, molten glassy material will end up in a very turbulent motion, and very small droplets would be produced. And you can make an estimate of the size of these droplets by balancing the kinetic energy of internal motion of the liquid with the energy associated with its surface tension. So there is one point which is perhaps a serious problem for the theory I'm putting forward. What I'm basically saying is that planets and stars have the same origin. They're both produced in the first instance by gravitational collapse. And there is, however, a phenomenon known as the brown dwarf desert. It seems that if you look at the masses of known bodies, there is a gap in the distribution between planets on the one hand and stars on the other. So the brown dwarf desert is, I think, the strongest counter-argument to the claims I'm making, in that this is an indication of there being two distinct origins for planets and stars. But it's not a killer argument, because when the small bodies produced by gravitational collapse collide with each other, well, in collision processes, there's typically a winner-takes-all phenomenon, where the larger bodies accrete additional material at a higher rate. So yes, admittedly, this is an issue to be resolved, but not necessarily a crucial one. And well, I'll stop there and ask for comments and questions.
Thank you.
In the next few years, there should be a dramatic increase in the number of planets on very large orbits discovered by direct detection surveys that are coming up, probably maybe about 100 or 100, something like that, hopefully.
Yeah.
Perhaps that's a way to test your picture, to look at the occurrence rate and the mass distribution of planets in larger orbits, because it becomes more and more difficult to make those in the standard picture as you go out to longer and longer dynamical times.
That is true. That's a good point. There could be other experimental tests. If there was evidence for variability in the luminosity of very young stars consistent with there already being planet-like bodies orbiting around, that could also provide an indication of the validity of my theory. I don't know whether there's work being done on that yet, though.
So, two things, planetesimals in our solar system and comets. Mm-hmm. So, both are pretty abundant, and with both species you can show that they have never been part of larger objects.
Yep.
So, and they must have been growing from primordial dust in our solar system. You find in comets really pristine dust grains being glued together by pristine ice and so on.
Yeah.
So we have experimental proof that collision led to the formation of self-gravitating built objects. So, and also in the planetesimal belt, it's not that these are fragments from planet-sized objects, but at most 1,000-kilometer-sized planetesimals. So, but nothing larger. So, yeah. I think this is a clear contradiction to what you say.
I'm not sure about that. In terms of, I think you raised two points. One was comets. Well, those may indeed contain pristine material. I'm not actually sure of the evidence one way or the other. But they've had a long while to they've had a long, long time to develop. So I'm not saying that nothing could have grown to a significant size by accumulating material in the outer reaches of the solar system. I'm expressing doubts that this mechanism could have worked to form planets.
Well, it works faster the closer you are to the star, so because it works with dynamical time scales and proportional to your density. If it works at 30 AU, it will work at 5 AU.
Well, not necessarily, because some of the doubts that I have about the standard mechanism are doubts that would weigh heavily when you're close in, and in particular issues of relative velocity of colliding balls of dust serious questions in the inner active regions of the circumstellar disk. That's less of an issue when you're further out, I believe. The other question you raised was about other evidence for planetesimals.
Asteroid belt, yes.
Yes, yeah. Well, okay. Well, my answer to that is that I've in effect argued that the solar system is rather special. I gave an argument for the origin of the chondrule bodies, which said that these can be caused by the after effects of a collision between objects which have a rocky core and which would scatter material far and wide. I think is consistent. So this, the existence of these objects is consistent with a model where rocky objects underwent some sort of a collision early on in the process. And I've argued that the rocky cores of juvenile planets could be such objects. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the existence of the asteroid belt is any contradiction. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say that it's easier to make asteroids in my scenario than it is in the standard. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah.
I wonder if the actual high-density nodes that are observed in stellar and galactic jets can be considered anomalous fragmentations, and then some way can start to gravitate and produce something like small planets and similar things.
Yes.
Something that can be considered feasible or not?
Yeah. I think those are. I'm not enough of an astrophysicist to be able to give a good answer to that.
It's,
concerning areas, I'm not.
Really we have some that can speculate. So.
Yeah.
Word? No volunteers.
The
notes,
exactly.
Yeah. How do you think these chondrules or these glass beads are being heated then?
Okay, if you have collisions between bodies which contain rocky material, any collision that happens in the solar system is going to be extremely energetic, with relative speeds of, well, at least 1,000 meters per second. If you convert 1,000 meters per second into a temperature, that's the melting point of glass.
Yes.
So the idea is that the collisions would have caused bodies to melt if they weren't molten already, and also the extreme amount of kinetic energy would have caused material to be scattered far and wide.
Yes.
And if I make a crude estimate, I do get roughly the right size scale.
But that could happen in any scenario, couldn't it?
I think the chondrules are a problem for the standard scenario because it's not clear where the source of energy came from to melt these things.
So that's not a problem that it's not possible, but that there are too many possible explanations, so...
there are many, many possible explanations, but I didn't find any of them either intuitively appealing or to be backed by any calculation. So there are explanations that involve lightning, for example.
Laser lightning.
Like in the atmosphere.
Just like in the atmosphere. The circumstellar disk is a cloud of gas in turbulent motion. There will be fictional charge transfers when grains of dust collide, all sorts of other mechanisms similar to the ones in our atmosphere. So it's plausible that lightning would happen. However, what's implausible is that the lightning is capable of melting, there's anything present that's large enough to be melted into a little 1 millimeter sized globule.
The volcanoes are beautiful lightning storms.
They do, yeah.
Even small storms, right? Exactly.
Yeah, but they're just dust storms, right? There's no water. Mm-hmm.
So that means this thing happened in the early period of the solar system, and there were a lot of collisions going on.
In both Hilbert's standard model and in mine, these particles would have been formed very early on, but by different mechanisms.
What do you mean by early on?
At the stage when the accretion disk is still present.
Yes. Okay. But before the solar system during the case time when the solar system is being built.
It's being built. Yeah.
So over a time of 10 million years, you have them formed at all times. They are not the oldest material in the solar nebula, and you can estimate that if planetesimal formation works, then they are already existing, and planets are existing before the last family of chondrules is being formed. Mm-hmm. So
these things cannot be dated, can they?
Yes, they are, sure.
How do you date them?
Radioactivity.
I see, so you know roughly when they were.
Exactly. By the time when the cloud was collapsing, there was some injection of radioactive material, and this set a clock, and that's why we...
Yeah, but you don't know about the history of this thing, so you don't know whether it has been sintered and blown apart and re-sintered and blown apart again.
So
and the radioactivity doesn't change because it was re-sintered.
That's the point. So you're basically freezing the chemical composition at the time when the last sintering or whatever occurred.
The last sintering, as it
was. Or the last solidification, so.
Right, but I mean, geologists can tell you from the size of the droplets, whether they're droplets or whether it's how it was sintered, and I mean geologists know a lot about rocks.
Oh yes, sure. And there's
so they know what the pressure is going to be, and they probably can tell you what the pressure is. And,
yes.
I mean, they know an awful lot about rocks.
So how the temperatures were, and also the precise cooling curve in order to form these spheres.
To form this, right? Because they know a lot.
Then the crystallization would be lower. They would be cooling too fast, even slower than other crystallization would be there. So they really have a peculiar parameter space how to form them. And it's funny that they are all the same size. That's why in the standard model, so to speak, they are all arguing about aerodynamic effects, that some turbulence was involved in this, that these were concentrated, for instance, at the Kolmogorov scale. So that's why there are these mixed up roughly millimeter-sized particles.
That's where the millimeter-sized particles.
That's where it comes from. Yes.
So that's where the caustics come from.
They come and play.
Yes, actually an interesting point about the chondrules is that they're magnetized. That is consistent with them having been formed in inside a large rocky body that would produce its own magnetic field. I don't know if there's an argument to explain the magnetization of the chondrule particles from the standard model.
Probably.
Yeah. But I think the fact that they're magnetized is also a significant issue that needs to be explained.
Mm-hmm. So what we're saying, the dynamo of this, the Earth dynamo or something would have already been in operation then, yeah? Your dynamo works with iron cores. Iron solidifying and stuff.
So my my model says that the origin of these things is that you had a rocky object, possibly with a magnetically active core. There's undervented collision, scattered material everywhere. So that explains why the scattered material is magnetized.
But you can, there is a method of adiabatic demagnetization to determine how old the magnetization is. Mm-hmm. Right, which people...
I don't imagine how that works.
Well, what they do is they put it in an alternating magnetic field and demagnetize slowly.
Yeah.
And from that they can actually determine how long this thing has been magnetized, isn't it, what they do? I mean, I have to read it.
I think there is
They were collecting, by the way, there was a guy when I was studying, yeah, collected rocks at Hadrian's Wall, because Hadrian's Wall is very nice and has been sitting for a while in the magnetic field. So in other words, what you can, these guys have not seen a new magnetic field, right?
Well, there's a very direct evidence for that.
Yes. They have not seen it, so that's what they do. So I'm wrong. Okay. What they do is they take, basically, Hadrian's Wall, some guy took a piece of rock,
uh-huh,
and put it up in a different direction than the magnetic field is.
Yeah.
Because of that, the rock slowly lost its magnetization. And from that, they can determine when the wall was split. This is something completely different.
Ah, okay.
There is evidence that magnetization is primordial. That's that the, if you pick these things out of a meteorite, you can look at the axes in which the magnetization points. It's different for all of them. That indicates that they were magnetized before the...
Lots of different magnetizations.
Yeah.
But I mean, the idea was that otherwise you had the disk which was magnetized, but that's true.
Whether that's sufficient to produce the magnetic field,
that's the suggestion so far.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that there's lots to be done, and there's coffee time.
Yeah.
Thank you.